Hello, I am Big Ben. If, like me, you are fascinated by all the performers, all the influences, all the tips and all the resources and props mentioned in this podcast, and you want to learn more, then go to www.thebigbenshow.com/podcasts. There you will find detailed show notes for every single episode, as well as the occasional photo and video. So check it out and get re-inspired about your shows. Alrighty, let's get back to this week's discussion.
Oh my goodness, look at these reviews. Listen to this. Hilarious and original, The Times. It is difficult to find enough superlatives to describe Steve Rawlings, the stage. Will give you more belly laughs than any comic. The Guardian. High praise indeed, and, well, rightly so. This week I'm talking to the great comedy juggler, Steve Rawlings. Take it away, Steve.
I guess, right, back in about, I want to say, like, maybe 1992, I was,
yeah.
So that's currently 26 years ago, maybe. I was president of my university's juggling club, and we went to a national British juggling convention or some convention somewhere in the UK, and I seem to remember you being one of the star acts at the public show.
Well,
do you remember anything about that?
96 was probably Birmingham.
Birmingham, oh, maybe it was Birmingham. Oh, 96, yes. That's probably maybe where it was.
I don't do many of those, so...
that could be the one.
Out in my mind when I do.
No, that could be the one, yes, because...
Was there a leaky tent?
Probably, because in 1996 I was living in Singapore, but I went back to the UK for the British juggling, British conventions and the European one, which was in France. Yeah, so maybe I saw you there. Oh, cool. It's amazing.
Yes, I remember it rained and the water was coming through the back and getting the kit wet.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, cool. It's amazing. So here, about 25 or so years later, I find the...
You're living in Hong Kong now, is it?
I'm in Hong Kong now, yeah.
So awesome.
I've been... When I was first starting juggling in the UK in the early 90s, I had no idea it would become a job. I had no idea that it could even become a career. And yet there you were. You were already doing it full-time, doing shows.
Yeah.
So
it was going really well, yeah.
And, I mean... No, carry on, it's okay.
I guess at the time I was doing a lot of touring with quite a few big-name acts and quite a lot of TV.
Wow.
In those days.
Were there like booms of ebbs and flows of being sort of on TV and in fashion, and then years when it wasn't a thing to be on TV?
It's more a case, excuse me, where TV was kind of where you went to and what you did, and then it became less of a thing that TV is what you did because there wasn't much TV left.
Right.
And when I first started to break in probably about the mid to late 80s, there was all kinds of TV to do and lots of interest. Comedy clubs were just getting up and running in a big way. Jonglers probably had only two clubs at the time. And if you did those clubs, the people, there was always TV people there, always. Every weekend there'd be somebody else to talk to and someone with a project going on, or you'd be picked up for Saturday Live or something like that.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, later in the 90s and probably early 2000s, there were less and less and less programs to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I do the same program two or three times.
Fantastic.
You know, one management would go in, one would come out, and they go, oh, we need a juggler. Call me without realising I'd already done it once.
Oh, so, man, 80s, early 90s, you were the right place, the right time, TV right work place, was there.
Right time, I guess right attitude.
Yeah.
I was, and also I was doing something different, I guess.
What do you mean by right attitude?
I was hungry, I was ambitious, I worked hard, yeah. That's what I mean.
All right.
I wanted to move forward and get somewhere.
Fantastic. Well, it's amazing. Your career is decades and decades now, isn't it?
Yeah, I started juggling at the end of 82.
That was my next question. Was 1982 a special year for you?
Well, it's the year when I actually found out what I wanted to do for a living.
Yeah.
I taught myself to juggling. I was in a very boring, dead-end job called the Civil Service, Post Office and Civil Service Sanatorium Society.
That does sound extremely boring.
Where I literally moved names from, it was a union thing, I think, where I moved names from one form to another. And I was really, really bored, and I got a Paul Daniels book and taught myself a couple of magic tricks, which I didn't really have the front to do. And I learned to juggle from nowhere, really. I just taught myself three balls and then didn't know how to take it further and then left it for a couple of years. Then I went to, I didn't really know what to do or where to go. I was doing rubbishy, dead-end jobs for years, about 4 years. Didn't fit anywhere, didn't like anything. And my backup job was as a lifeguard.
Yes.
If all else fails, don't do that for a while, because it's horribly boring. And if you get that bored, you switch off and somebody drowns, which wasn't really my plan. So I went to Butlins as a lifeguard, just for something to do, really, have a bit of fun and, you know, just a bit of an adventure.
Okay, I'm just going to jump in quickly, Steve. Just to people who listen overseas, Paul Daniels was the British TV magic magician.
Oh, right, sorry, yeah.
And Butlins is a holiday camp.
It's a holiday camp.
A holiday camp, yeah.
An English holiday camp, yeah.
Yeah.
And Paul Daniels was the man.
That's right.
Probably about for 15 years.
Yeah.
And if you got on his program, that was it. There was no higher thing in the UK. I didn't, sadly. But probably a little bit early in my career, but that was the one to do if you could.
Yeah.
So I went as a lifeguard to Butlins, and they used to make you help out with redcoat duties as well,
yes.
Which was just in competitions and all the rest of it. And at the end of the season, Salvation Army took over the whole camp, and the kids they bring with them were horrendous. So all the junior reds that looked after them knew that and left. So they were like dragging people in to help out on stage, and they made me kicking and screaming. I have to say, I didn't want to do it at all.
Yeah.
Got on a stage and just went, ooh, this is fun. And it's the first thing I'd really sort of clicked to, first thing I'd liked.
Yeah.
So when I left Butlins, I went to try and find something else that would get me back on stage.
Yeah.
And at the time, the mime thing was too expensive. I couldn't afford it on Butlins wages. The clown one was full, and there was a group called Original Mixture. I don't know if you ever met them.
No.
Doug, Mitch and Andy, who were probably one of the only groups out there at the time. And they were teaching juggling in a place called Oval House, opposite Kennington Oval. So I went there, and that was it. That was all I ever wanted to do after learning to juggle with them.
Fantastic.
After meeting other jugglers, that was it.
Oh, that's amazing. All right, let's just backtrack and talk about some of that stuff then. So you actually taught yourself to juggle. Now, in those days, there's no YouTube, there's no internet. So how on earth did you learn?
I've got a vague memory of maybe seeing someone at a circus do it. My mum and dad took me to the occasional circus.
Yeah.
And I just worked it out.
Really?
I couldn't work out find four balls. Because I did three and then thought, well, I'll try four now, and couldn't work it out.
Oh,
I was
yeah.
just switching the fourth ball as another third ball, really.
But that's still pretty impressive that you figured out the three balls went in a kind of infinity sign cascade rather than in a circle.
No, it was the cascade thing I worked out. I don't know how, I just did. And then because I couldn't take it any further and didn't know anyone else that juggled, that was it for a couple of years.
Okay. Wow. Okay. That's still, I'm going to clap. I mean, most people who try to teach themselves to juggle have no idea, would try to juggle the balls around in a circle. Which is much harder, a shower, jugglers call it.
Yeah.
But actually, to figure out it was what they called the cascade, where it goes in a sort of a sideways figure of eight. Yeah, wow.
Well, ta-ra.
And where did you buy, what did you juggle with back in 1982?
Well, it was bean bags.
Ah.
That was pre-82, that was probably 79, 80. But yeah, when I first met the original mixture guys and the guys at the workshop, a few people had clubs,
mm-hmm.
but they had to come from America, basically.
Yeah.
And we had bean bags, not the ones you see now. There was a guy called Malcolm who once a year would get a whole bunch of cloth and some bird seed, and he'd make he'd literally, so got a plane coming over.
That's good. It's an international show. It's an international podcast.
Yeah. And Malcolm would make the bounce from about 300 balls, and if you didn't buy from Malcolm, there were no balls, basically.
Wow.
But the thing was, because they were cloth and bird seed, if they ever got wet, they grew. they became hard little balls of stuff, and then plants would come out. So you had to make sure you kept them dry.
Ah, you see, people...
We also tried to make our own clubs. So we'd have, like, a squash bottle with the bottom cut off.
Yeah.
And half a dog ball stuck on the bottom to give it a bit of weight. And then a dowel stuck down the neck.
Yeah, and you tell kids these days, that's what we had to do, they won't believe you. What, you didn't order it online on the internet? No, we used to make it.
I'm very old now. I mean, there were people like the Mendezes, who I met later at Covent Garden, who went to America and would always come back with clubs.
Yeah.
And that was the sort of the ultimate.
Yeah.
To have proper clubs.
Yeah. So I'm slightly...
And Nicky B came along and made some, which were horrendous. They were like caveman rock at the beginning. And then, you know, things got better and more people joined in.
I'm slightly the generation after you. So when I started in about 1990, you could buy... There's some sort of a juggling boom, so you could buy the juggling clubs in the UK.
Yeah, the Oddballs guys were
That's right,
there,
Oddballs, yes. But to get the unicycles, that was harder, because we'd all heard about this Japanese unicycle called a Miata, and they weren't available in England, so that was the goal, to get a Miata.
I've never heard of them. DX, is it, or DMX?
Yeah, DMs. Yeah, Dave Mariner built those.
That's it.
Yeah.
They were the ones to have at the time for me, yeah.
And for those of you deeply interested in the history of unicycles, i.e. me, in the 1990s, in England, the best unicycle to buy was the DM, maybe the DM Ringmaster. In Holland, the great unicycle was the Semcycle, Sem Abraham's unicycle world champion, his family producing that, still a fantastic machine. And of course, in Japan, at that time, it was the Miata unicycle. These are the big ones that I remember. All right, let's get back to Steve. Yeah, DMs. Yeah, Dave Mariner built those.
That's it.
Yeah.
They were the ones to have at the time for me, yeah.
I've still got one behind me. A DM Giraffe, yeah. It's brilliant. I've had it for 25 years, still works. Sorry?
He made good stuff. It was good, solid engineering.
Yeah, mine's still going. I used it this afternoon.
Were you digging?
Yeah, I was doing a kindergarten graduation show.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so I thought, okay, I'm on stage, let's bring out the old the biggest unicycle, so I took that one out. It still works.
What was it, 5 foot?
Yeah, it's a 5 footer. It's his adjustable one, 5 to 8 foot, but the 8 foot one's just inconvenient, so you just take out the middle pole and it becomes 5 foot.
That's fantastic.
All right, cool. Had you ever been interested in performing on stage before you got on in the Bucklands holiday camp?
No, not even remotely.
Really?
Didn't occur to me at all.
No family influences?
My mum did some amateur dramatics.
Yeah.
And when I was little, I think I played Tiny Tim in the Dickens thing.
Christmas
Carol.
But
no, that was it.
All right. Were there any entertainers that you'd seen in the 70s and 80s? Anything that inspired you?
No.
No?
Well, in the 80s, of course, yes, once I started performing, then it was, you know, looking at other people and seeing what you liked.
Yeah.
So, for me, when I first went to Covent Garden to start performing...
Yeah.
I was working as a lifeguard still at Lady Well Baths in London.
I know the place.
Do you really?
I'm born in Greenwich. I've come from Greenwich.
Oh, blimey, yeah, I'm a Catford boy myself, so...
South East London.
Yeah, where the cabs don't go, yeah. And so what happened, basically, was I came back from Butlins and I was desperately juggling all the hours God gave and working as a lifeguard. And then I tried and died horribly at Covent Garden, and then I went back again and stayed out. But the people around at the time who were jugglers, and yeah, there really weren't many. My kind of hero was Tim Batt.
Okay.
Who was, sort of an eccentric gentleman performer. Lots of stuff with umbrella, hat, athlete was a big one for him. And his big finish was juggling a burning baguette, a frying pan, and an egg. And then he'd catch the egg in the pan, hold the lit baguette underneath, and do a little rhyme about eggs, and if the eggs are neat, it would be very nice to eat.
Fantastic!
And you had John Ballinger, who was the juggling jester.
Yeah.
And you had the Amazing Mendeezes,
yeah,
which was Chris Adams and Dave Mendeezy.
Yeah.
Dave Spansky, excuse me, apologies to Dave if he ever is this.
Get his name wrong.
Yeah, those are the boys out there doing good stuff.
Now, for people again listening overseas, Covent Garden was the place to go busking, or if you wanted to go and see a street performance show in the 1980s, it still is really, in London. A big kind of piazza, lots of open space, lots of tourists and shoppers, so ready-made audience walking past. And they redeveloped Covent Garden, and it became, there are all these lovely arty crafty shops around. And they have a great space for juggling there and great place for street performing in general,
yeah,
there, don't they?
A lot of performers, skills performers, made a start there, because where else can you go learn?
Yeah. So were you doing...
Once you've got these skills, where can you take it? Unless you can take it, I mean, my first shows, I think I was making, £3 a go, which even then wasn't much. Three shows, and I made just enough to come back again and have another go. But each time you do a show, you learn a little bit more, you tweak it, you try this, maybe if I do this. And, through trial and error and constant pain, you get better.
Yeah.
And where else could you have done that?
Yes. That was it. That was the place. And I talked to a lot of performers, and often the earliest shows they began, there's something there that has influenced their style throughout the whole of their career. So for me, my first paid gigs were as a Charlie Chaplin impersonator. And so up until that point, whenever I'd been on stage, I was always talking. But because about 25 years ago, I got this job as a Charlie Chaplin impersonator. Since then, there's things that I do to music without speaking, yeah, that I've just been stuck in my style forever.
That's not a bad thing.
And how about you?
That's not a bad thing at all.
How about you? Because if you're starting busking at Covent Garden, I'm guessing you don't have background music at that point, and so you're talking. I mean, it's gag-based, verbal talking whilst juggling, and I think, if I'm right, that's still your style, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And that's never going to change.
Yeah.
I couldn't shut up if I tried to. I was lucky enough that most of the people I was watching at the time were talking.
Yeah.
Were interacting with the audience in that way. I never had the skills of the level of, the top circus guys, so I'd never have been able to sort of compete on that level.
Yeah.
And comedy's always been my thing anyway. I always really wanted to mix the clowning, the gags, the business, the stand-up-y stuff,
yeah,
and the tricks together.
Yeah. Now...
It's... The character sort of came later. What made me came probably about 4 or 5 years in.
I read somewhere that you have your hat to collect your money while busking, and you put your hat on your head and turned up the brim, and that was sort of the first emerging of your stage character, the stage persona.
Yeah, that's exactly true. We were using his hat to bottle with, passing it around for the money,
yeah,
and while waiting, there's an awful lot of waiting that goes on at Covent Garden. While waiting, I stuck it in my head, and for some reason, that changed me.
Yeah.
I became somebody different with that hat on. And I annoyed everyone to the point where they just went, look, go around, is this funny? Does this work? Is this, what do you think? And they said, oh, shut up. And then, look, if you're going to keep doing it, just do it in the show and shut up. So I did, and the show was completely different. I was different, the show was different, there was a whole different vibe about it. And it started to work so much better.
Yeah.
And also with that, obviously, once you start to do something different and something creative, you get a lot more respect from, the people around you.
Yes.
And more interest.
Yes, because you're not copying it's someone. It's coming. There's something's definitely coming from you, isn't it?
It's come from you, and it's different. And welcome to the club. You're making your own thing now.
And for people who haven't seen you, how would you describe your character in a sentence or two?
I don't know, actually.
Let's put it this way. Do you ever get clients asking you to do projects and events that wouldn't suit your character? Do you have to perform in a different style?
No.
No.
No. It's always I always perform as I do.
Yeah.
That's what I do, and that's what you get, and that's what you buy. Yeah.
I would say.
Sorry.
I would say the character's just funny, ludicrous, larger than life, talking and juggling with honestly stupid, silly things.
He's a slightly strange, manic, crazy character that's struggling and killing himself to try and do the stuff he's decided he's going to do for you, I suppose.
That's right. Yeah, there's a frenetic energy to it. He also he laughs and he giggles a bit, doesn't he, as well?
Yeah, it's a very strong, rather mad character that if you knew me in normal life is nothing like me.
Yeah.
But he's obviously, it's a small part of me that I've just expanded and made much, much bigger.
Yeah.
Which is probably, I think, the way to go if you're going to do a stage character is take part of you that you feel works.
Yeah.
And see where it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's brilliant. People should check you out on YouTube or look at your website and look at your videos.
Yes, definitely they should. There's quite a bit out there now, yeah.
Yeah, the character is so cool. It's very, very funny.
Thank you.
Also, before we move on, there's something I quickly want to talk about. So you started performing at Covent Garden busking, I guess, early to mid 1980s, something like that, 1980s?
Yeah.
And is there anything you remember about that scene? Anything good or anything bad? Or is there any...
In what respect?
It could be something specific. Like, is there anything you that sticks in your mind? I can remember busking in Singapore in the 1990s, where it was almost unheard of to do a performance in the street. And they'd certainly never seen a living statue. And my living statue act was so simple, I didn't even have to wear makeup. I just dressed with a bowler hat and a pinstripe suit and an umbrella and a briefcase, like you're kind of the stereotypical English businessman. And I just stood there in the equatorial sunshine in totally the wrong uniform. Yeah, I just stood totally still. And people in Singapore had never seen a living statue, and despite the fact that I got no makeup on, they didn't know whether I was a human being or not. They'd never, ever seen anything like it, and it was just wonderful for 6 months. Nobody had ever seen anything like it. That's pretty cool.
And then the other statues started to come out.
And then there were hundreds of them, yeah.
You had the 6 months to yourself, though. That's very cool.
Another story for me, I remember busking and quite early on, realizing that I've got to keep an eye on what equipment I leave behind me because someone just stole it while I was doing a show. I mean, this was before there was any real busking in Singapore. So the audience didn't know how to behave. And I think one little kid, a teenager, just walking along, there's a white guy And there's his bag. I'm going to walk off with that.
Yeah, that's a shame. Kills the moment for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of changes the show a bit, doesn't it? Okay, you better give me some money now to pay for all the time I've lost.
I mean, yeah, Covent Garden is not for lightweights. It was getting there at 4 or 5 in the morning to sign onto the lists.
Yeah.
Long, long days. Some very, very hard shows, practicing all day, working in the snow, in the rain.
Yeah.
I mean, there are two pitches there. There's one outdoors and there's one in. And I've still got very strong memories of being in the sort of nearest coffee shop and running out while I was still warm enough to do the show.
Yeah.
And you could feel your hands slowly freezing up.
Yeah.
You know, as the show goes on. I mean, I remember about 12 of us all sort of helping each other out with shows on the indoor pitch because it was so cold, where we'd all sort of gather around each other's acts.
Yeah.
And clap each other loudly and scream and shout and all the rest of it to try and get an audience.
Yeah.
And of those people, now you had probably, there was Eddie Izzard, there was Dave Benson Phillips,
who
was kids presenter. There was myself, I think there was probably John Lenihan, well-known magician and author. Yeah, there was a bunch of us that all went on and did well for ourselves.
Yeah.
Not as well as Eddie, I don't think, but...
Yeah, Eddie Izzard.
I guess the drive follows through.
Wow. How about the cold? That's something I haven't really experienced much. I've often worked in really hot countries. Is it hard to perform? Are there any particular problems juggling when your hands are freezing up?
Juggling itself is becomes a problem. And boy, does it hurt your hands with the clubs.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
It's just trying to keep warm. And then once you get going, you know, keeping it frenetic enough and moving enough that you've just got enough to keep going until the end. But for me, my last 10 minutes was a balancing routine, so it was easier for me than for some others. But the deal with the Covent Garden was that if you just came for the summer, you're a bit of a lightweight, you didn't get much respect.
Right.
But if you did the winter, you were hardcore and you were and you became accepted.
So did you move on to doing this full time? First of all, you're doing it part-time, and then pretty soon you said, I'm going to go back there again and I'm going to stay at Covent Garden full-time.
Yeah, I had one bash at it where it didn't work. I didn't make enough money.
Yeah.
I thought, right, I have to go back to lifeguarding. And then I had, I think, a two-week holiday. Took it and then stayed out. That was it. As soon as I felt I was making enough to just about make a living, that was it. I'm done. I'm gone. And this is it.
And was this pre-amplifiers and pre-mics? Were you just doing it all with...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, we were all shouting. Everyone was projecting as madly as we could.
Yeah.
When the first guy came down with a microphone, he had a handheld radio mic.
Okay.
And he was laughed out of the place. He was ridiculed and pointed at and laughed at. And this is busking. You don't bring, microphones to a busking show.
Yeah, that's all changed.
Oh, hasn't it? Yes, yeah.
Did you have any problems projecting your voice day after day, or did you learn how to make sure you don't strain it?
You kind of learn how to sort of bawl out as loudly as you could. But it's obviously, if you did too many shows in a day, you would start to lose it.
Yeah.
I had a few problems in festivals where, before amplification became normal, where, the voice just went.
Yeah. And I think the voice is pretty much essential to your show, isn't it?
Yeah, I have performed silent, but it's really not me.
Right,
I don't like it very much.
Yeah,
I guess you learn more different skills. The more you perform silent, the more you learn that it can be done, and the better you get at it.
Yeah, I kind of go to and fro. I had a silent bit when I was Charlie Chaplin. Then I went to talking. Then I went back to silent for a while. So my character has changed a bit, but generally I start my show silently, then I have a talky bit with it with the audience and volunteers, and then I do a big finish, which is also talking. So it's kind of half-half now. Has your character...
Yeah, I think if you do learn to perform silent, you'll also learn skills and find new bits that will work in your speaking show.
Yeah,
and probably vice,
And also I find... if I've moved to different countries, the character of my show, the character in my show has changed. So, like, when I was in England, I was only a student and a teenager, but I guess it was kind of, the audience was more knowing, you could be more subtle. When I went to Singapore, you could not be subtle, they wouldn't get it. You had to be really slapstick and really broad humour, just your trousers falling off, hitting yourself on the head kind of stuff.
Yeah, each time you work for a different nationality, I think you have to leave some of your gags behind, some of your business. But you find new stuff. You find what amuses them, and that goes in instead. And some of it will cross over. As a verbal performer, as well as visual, I have to take all the gags that are reference-based, like cultural-based.
Yes.
And then you have to look at all the rest of your stuff and take out anything that's a language-based joke. And so it's quite shocking and surprising how many of them you've got.
Right.
And then what's left is pretty much what you're going to have.
So if you're performing...
there's a couple through incomprehension. Mm.
So if you're performing in England and then you take your show to Germany, are there any particular things that you wouldn't do in England or you'd do more of in Germany or vice versa?
There have been quite a few changes, but most of it in Germany works. Obviously, a lot of the verbal jokes went.
Mm.
And Germans have their language is quite different to ours in that the punch of a sentence might not come at the end, as it would in ours.
That's right. The sentence structure is different, yeah.
The sentence structure is different, and that was a little bit weird as to how to sell the strengths of the joke.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating, because you can't translate it, because the punchline might come at the start of...
You can translate it, but where do you put the force of the sentence?
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
So that was a bit different. And some jokes are funnier in some places than others. Some just don't work.
Yeah.
In Japan, the most clear reference I can think of is the old bouncy hanky joke.
Right.
Where you blow your nose on hanky and then bounce it on the floor or bounce it into your bag, whatever.
Oh, right. As if your snot, as if your bogeys are bouncy. Yeah.
But in Japan, if you blow your nose in a handkerchief, it's funny because it's quite rude and daft and... only a Westerner would do it, really.
Right.
But bouncing the handkerchief was like, why do you put a ball in his handkerchief? it just didn't work. I'm not saying it's a great gag in England either, but it's a gag and it's a bit of business. And that's a more clear representation. Also, the biggest laugh I had in Japan was in a very weird place.
Yeah?
If you know the act... well, I do the last 10 minutes is a bottle balancing routine where I try a bottle on my face, and it's basically 10 minutes of extreme overacting where I have a volunteer, a lady from the audience with a tray of glasses, running around after me trying to help me put the glasses on.
Oh, I love this.
And the biggest laugh I ever got in Japan, the biggest gag of the whole show was I'd have her running round, and then I'd finish that bit and I'd send it back to the audience in Japanese, thank you very much, whatever. And then I'd scream for help. And then she'd come running back, and Japanese women take these very dainty little steps. But there was an awful lot of very small, very fast, dainty little steps till she got back to me. And then I'd say in Japanese, otsukare samadeshita, which means thank you very much for all your hard work. So basically, I've called her all the way back for nothing. And then I've been extremely polite. And the mix of the two went over really well for me.
Amazing. That's lovely. I like that.
That would be a nice example of where you take the changes and make them your own.
Yeah. And that worked really well in Japan.
Yeah, that was a killer gag. Big laugh.
Cool. Oh, that's great. Oh, before we go any further, another tricky one. Could you describe kind of your style and your image? For example, describe the bags that your show comes in.
My travel bags?
Yes.
Right, I've got what looks like a very large body bag or a badly built golf bag.
Yeah.
Which contains a chair, a bentwood chair, a table, 4 golf clubs, normally a volleyball, and some other bits and bobs. Then I've got a size 28 wheelie soft bag that's got most of the rest, pretty much all of the rest of the show, bowling balls, knives, that kind of stuff.
When you met, say, when you say a wheelie soft bag, you mean like kind of a, it's like a kind of, it looks a bit like a large suitcase kind of thing.
Yeah. Not one of the hard shell ones. One of the canvassy things, yeah.
I've got one right next to me here. I'm going to hit it. Yeah.
I've got my carry-on bag, which if they ever weigh it, I'm destroyed, because that's full of China crockery, basically. I've got two cups and saucers in there. I've got about six China dinner plates, some paper plates, and then I think two mouse sticks. And that would be that's my travel.
Is it quite transportable? How important is transportability for you?
It's huge.
Yeah.
I couldn't take any more. I couldn't expand any more than I do and keep up the work that I do.
So can you carry all this as one person?
Yes, I can.
Ah, there you are. Yeah.
There'll come a point when I can't, I'm sure, but at the moment it's all good.
So even the chair and the table, you can carry that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because basically the chair goes upside down on the seat of the table, and that goes in the golf bag thing, the body bag, which goes over the shoulder, and then the other two bags, one goes on top of the other and are carried along.
Yeah.
But that's it. I can't take any more. The reason I got into mouse stick stuff is because I need something that doesn't add weight and bulk.
Yeah, something that plays small and packs small, but can play large, can get a lot out of it.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a set of cartwheels, literally cartwheels down the shed. It's an amazing trick. It's an incredible.
I've seen it. There is one clip on YouTube of you doing it.
Yeah, it's an incredible trick, but it's, unless I'm in a car, you can't really travel it.
Okay, that was going to be one of my questions, because I remember early on mentioning that I've got a giraffe unicycle that I used, that I rarely use, but I use today. And it's the same thing. If you've got a unicycle that can go up to 8 foot high, it's great, but it's so hard to get that and all the rest of your stuff to a gig. And if you've got two gigs in one day, it's even harder. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the whole sort of travelling thing does wear a bit.
Yeah.
And you find coping mechanisms, but you always find yourself at some point having to do 500 yards to a quarter of a mile with carrying it all.
Yeah.
Upstairs, downstairs, you know, to the train station, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Or from the airport to wherever.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want is to pull a muscle not doing the show.
I know. I mean, for me, actually, I think often the transport and getting to the show is harder than doing the show quite often.
And also, yeah, you've got to pay for the excess baggage and stuff.
Yeah.
If you're doing airports, and even if you're doing the Eurostars, I found out the other day.
Oh. Before we move on as well, I just want to explain. You said a cartwheel, yeah. So you have got this huge wooden wheel. It's like over a meter in diameter. And you have a trick. Well, you have two of them, don't you? And you have a trick where they're balancing and spinning on your head. Is that right?
Yeah. There's actually three wheels.
Wow.
I was looking to do the app where you have a cartwheel on a pole and you knock it down and you catch the cartwheel on your head on a German spike helmet.
Wow.
That somebody used to do many years ago. And then a friend of mine just went, "I've got cartwheels for you."
Oh.
I was working in Blackpool. On the North Pier at the time, and there was an act called the Marganers, who had I think they're Hungarian or Bulgarian, something like that. And they had this Roman strongman act that they were doing. And I literally bought all their props. And the two cartwheels balance, and the three cartwheels also balance. But the only time I've ever done that, I lifted it all over my head. And it's probably a good 8 stone altogether.
Wow.
And I literally just fell over backwards. So I stuck to the two, which is about 6 stone and heavy enough, really.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
But, I rigged the bottom, the big wheel, so you could spin it. I took it to a metal worker and got some bearings put in so you could spin the big wheel.
Ah.
Which seemed like a big idea until I realised that the actual wheel rim, which is, I don't know, probably 6 centimetres across, every time that spins, twice every spin, your face is covered.
Oh.
Which hadn't occurred to me at all at the time. But yeah, I got around it, but it made it an awful lot more difficult to learn.
So if your face is covered, that means you're blind. You can't see what's happening.
Literally,
yeah,
literally, for like a second there, you lose what you're balancing by.
Oh, yeah. That's a tricky one. Oh, that's such a specific tip. I love specific tips. So if you're balancing a spinning cartwheel on your head, beware the cartwheel's diameter is going to block your eyes as it spins past them.
Yeah, twice every 2 seconds or whatever.
Oh, also...
That came as a surprise.
Also, I mean, street performing was taking off in Covent Garden in the 80s, but also there was stand-up comedy was taking off, wasn't it? There was the comedy club that you performed in.
Yeah, I worked the comedy circuit for years, literally. Paid my mortgage for years doing it.
Oh, really?
Go on.
No, was that a big source of your income, percentage-wise? Doing...
Oh, huge.
Ah.
Huge, for quite a few years. From maybe 86 until probably the last one I ever did, around about 2000.
Yeah.
Although there's still the Hard Bloody Hard Clubs in England, the Bearcat. I'll still do, if I possibly can, just because I like them, I like the guy that runs them and the guys that run them, and it's nice to sort of just see what everyone else is doing.
Wow. So when you were performing full-time back then, you were doing Covent Garden and any other things that came your way, and one of the things that came your way was performing in the stand-up comedy clubs, because there was a boom at that time.
Yeah, it came my way. I pushed my way in. Because in those days, it was different. Because everyone with a crazy idea was doing it. It wasn't like it is now. It wasn't like one guy, one microphone.
Yeah.
There were all kinds of people. There were fakirs, there were magicians, there were a cappella groups, there were groups, there were duos, there was improv groups, there were jugglers, there was everything. And over time, it's come down to pretty much one guy, one mic.
Mm.
But in those days, because there was such a variety of stuff going on, it was anyone with any kind of idea, you could just go up and give it a go.
Wow.
And Jonglers was the club to do at the time. There was only one club in Battersea when I started doing them. And I bowled up with all my gear because I'd been watching the shows at the Tunnel Club, which was run by a guy called Malcolm Hardy. It was a pit of a gig. It was really, really probably one of the strangest and hardest gigs you'll ever do in your life. But I'd seen there, and I knew you could just rock up and do an open spot. And I looked at Battersea, and I thought, right, that's the place for me. So I bowled up with all my gear, and they went, no, you can't just turn up. You have to book a spot. Okay, when can I come back then? Oh, 6 months. Okay, fine. So literally, I rocked back up in 6 months' time with all my gear ready to go on stage.
Yeah.
And they forgot all about me completely. It hadn't occurred to me that they were just fobbing me off. So I was there with all my gear, and they went, all right, okay, fine, you can do a spot. And I did an open spot then, and that went okay. And then they put me on New Year's Eve, bizarrely enough.
Wow.
After 12 o'clock.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's cool.
After the band had got everyone on the tables singing, dancing, and whatever. And
sit down again.
The compere, it was Arthur Smith, came on and said, right, Lindsay, we're going to calm it all down now. We've got a juggler for you.
Oh, dear.
So I went on, and half of the crowd had decided to sort of let me finish and just, you know, all right, let him do his thing and we can party afterwards. And the other half hated me and wanted me gone. So I got to the bottle balance, and it was just about still flying. And then one of those farty noisy balloons thing went round the room, and that was quite amusing. Then I think a matchbox hit the back of the stage behind me, followed by one of the spray cans, the snow spray cans.
Yeah.
And then a glass ashtray, which narrowly missed, I think. And Ainsley Harriott, actually, funnily enough, he has a brother who's as wide as Ainsley is tall. Very strong guy, because it went very quiet after the ashtray. And I found out later what happened was that Ainsley's brother had gone over and had a very quiet word about putting people's faces through windows if they threw anything out. And I got off, I finished the act as fast as I could and got off stage. And everyone went back to partying, but I owe Aidan Flea and his brother for that one. But from that, I started doing Jonglers regularly, and from that I started getting seen by producers and TV guys and, you know, all kinds of people.
Wow. All right.
And then as the comedy circuit expanded, I kind of went with it and did all those shows, all those venues.
Oh, fantastic.
For, you know, long old time.
That's amazing.
I was lucky enough to work with all kinds of people, obviously, like the Jack D's, the Eddie Izzards, the Lee Evans.
Wow.
Marcus Brigstock, all these people, Joe Brand, Sarah Millican, all these people, you know, I was just really lucky to see them all learn their craft and be part of shows with them.
God, that's amazing. What a story.
Yeah.
Wow.
So many talented people.
How did you deal with taking your act from the street with no microphone to performing with a microphone in a small on a small stage?
I've never quite lost the shouting thing, sadly. Okay. I try very hard, but there's something about when you go from street to using a microphone, obviously they all use them now, but at the time, where you never quite feel that you're selling the gag right.
Yeah.
You haven't screamed it. And it takes an awful lot of time and patience. But I don't think there's a little edge to it that never quite leaves.
And how did you cope with, because you need your hands free for juggling and there's a microphone, so how did you cope with that problem?
A lot of the time they had radio mics.
All right.
The venues would realise that we weren't jugglers, we're going to have to get some radio mics in. And the other thing was one of the best bits of advice I've ever had, actually, on sound,
mm-hmm.
was... I'd lost my voice in the Edmonton Street Festival, and this busker came up and said, oh, I can help you with that. And I went, yeah, whatever. And he said, no, what you need is this. And I ignored him, and he just made me one and brought it to me, and I used it. I've been forever grateful to him, even though I was not the most gracious person at the time. And it literally, you go and get a metal wire coat hanger.
Uh-huh.
And you get one of those, Gerber knives with... the strong clip thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you clip a piece off the metal coat hanger, you bend it into a circle.
Yeah.
And then you bend the ends back on themselves.
Yeah.
And then what you do is you get a shoelace and
yeah.
you tie it to the two hoops you've made by
yeah.
bending the wire back on itself. And you hang that over your neck, and anytime that your headset goes down, I always have like a handheld radio mic on a stand nearby.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I sweat out the mic doesn't work for any reason. I literally just go and pick up the mic, slot it into the little loop I've got around my neck, and I'm back in business.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So if I turn up and for some reason they haven't bothered, or they didn't realise, or I thought they were getting a microphone, and all they've got is a handheld, literally just take it, shove it in the loop, and away we go. But don't do neck catches if you're going to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, do the neck catch by all means, but don't try and flick the ball back up because the microphone will smack you straight in the teeth.
Yeah, I find a problem with that is if I've got the microphone in a clothes hanger around my neck, if I jump onto my giraffe and I do the fake miss where I kind of fall off the giraffe again, I have to make sure my chin doesn't get anywhere near the giraffe's seat, otherwise the microphone gets smashed right into my mouth and I will bleed.
Yeah.
And it has happened.
Yeah. Some cultures will deal with a bit of blood, but others, it's just a little too far that they want to go.
I've got a clothes... do we call it a clothes hanger or a coat hanger? I've got one of those bits of wire turned into a microphone holder, and I've had one for years, and I have no idea where the idea came from, whether it was my idea or if I saw somebody... Because I was in Singapore where there were no other performers, so I don't know how I came
with that. You probably made it up yourself.
Maybe I did, yeah.
Basic sense, because you can buy stuff, for, you know, quite expensive, 20 quid or something.
But you don't need to.
Probably more now.
Yeah.
But you don't need to. Just literally get a wire coat hanger and make your own.
Yeah.
Take seconds and cost about tuppence.
That's right. Also, I've seen you a video on YouTube, very early one. You were at a comedy club and you had a waistcoat and you just shoved the microphone... up the wire up your waistcoat so it was poking out the top. Was that a regular habit?
No. It was a last moment desperation probably. But I mean, there is a way also where you can use a lead mic and just there's a way of wrapping it that creates a loop that you can just hang the mic in.
Yeah.
Was it Paul Zenon showed me? I've just forgotten how to do it now.
Right.
Maybe we should get hold of him and get him to show us.
Yeah, get him to show us. We'll search him down.
Yeah, because it is fairly easy. It's just, and it's also a lifesaver.
Exactly. Yeah, we'd better try and search that one out. If anyone's listening and knows how it's done, let me know.
Yeah, please share it, because I'd like to know as well.
How about low ceilings? I guess some of those comedy clubs with small stages, low ceilings, was that ever a problem for your balancing, head balance?
As long as I've got about 8 foot, I'm fine.
Mm.
But the furniture juggling presents problems then, but I have managed it in an 8 foot ceiling.
And you haven't got any assistant when you're doing these kind of things, so how did you get all your props on and off stage fast enough?
Normally, I was on, either, I was normally, after a while, I was normally closing.
Right.
Or I was on at the end of the first half.
Oh, that makes sense.
Which would mean, obviously, there's a little bit of time to clear.
Yeah.
But if I wasn't, if I was doubling up or running away, then either I'd have to do it quick as I could. And obviously then you cut back down on the props you're going to use so that you've got a quicker get out.
Yeah.
Yeah, you look at what you're going to have to pack and run away with and go, okay, maybe that's not a good idea. Maybe I'll just use the easy stuff. And then literally you have to pack it yourself in front of everyone. It's not great, it's not good visuals, but there are no choices there.
Yeah.
Normally there's a sound guy there who'll give you a bit of a hand or the...
No, it's a perennial problem. You do a great show and it's like, oh, this is fantastic, and then for the next 5 minutes the audience watches your butt in the air as you bend over, put everything back in the box and push it off stage.
Yeah, if I've got any pet hates, it's the one where you're doing either a party or a gala where you're the last act and then there's the disco or the band.
Oh, yeah.
And you've just done the show and mine is particularly messy. There's stuff everywhere.
Yeah.
And literally, I just finish, and suddenly it's like, hey, and now your cover's bare, la la la, and bang, the band kicks up, all the lights go out, and everyone gets on the dance floor, and you're crawling between their legs trying to salvage a bit of your dignity, and some of your props before they, you know, people are wearing them as hats.
Oh, no.
But yeah, nobody tells you, and you can say all you like, I need to do this, this is the stuff that will be left on the stage when I finish. It won't make a difference.
No, okay.
You just have to take it on the chin and it's part of the game.
Yeah. Do you have a favourite microphone? Do you have a favourite microphone that you take to a gig or a corporate gig, for example, or do you use whatever's there?
I used to own my own microphone many years ago and it was stolen.
Oh.
And then I've come to the decision for myself that I won't ever have one.
Right.
I don't have my own. If you want to hire me, you need to provide sound.
Yeah, I think that's good because it means they've sound checked.
When I was touring my own mic, everyone expected me to be the sound guy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
For a living. That's not my deal.
Yeah.
And also, you probably find that the in-house system is the best you can have for that place.
Yes.
It's tuned to that place.
Yes.
And the other thing is, you'll find yourself turning up 3 or 4 hours earlier than you normally would, just so you can set your sound right.
Exactly. Yes, I agree. Same here.
And, you know, if it goes bad, that's your fault. As opposed to, I did my best, but the sound guy was...
That's true. Oh, one of the weird things...
Those are my reasons. A lot of people don't agree with them, I think, but that's my thing.
No, I'm the same with you on that. I use whatever they've got and whatever they have sound checked during the day, I'll use that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if it's a headset...
You'll get a better sound from it.
Yeah, if it's a headset, I'll use that. If it's a handheld mic, I'll use that clothes hanger and hook it to under my chin.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. That's how you get the best sound, I think.
And I'm going to leave it there because there's more stuff to put in about Steve next week. If you want to check Steve out, in the meantime, his website is steverawlingsjuggler.com, and I'll be back in a little while with part two of this great interview. Woo! Good stuff! Right, talk to you again soon. This was Meet the Entertainers, and I am Big Ben. Each episode takes a surprisingly large number of hours to prepare, record and edit, and check. and re-edit and re-record and edit again and throw in the bin and mend my computer and take it out of the bin and redo it from scratch and then post it again. So, if you're getting something out of this series, here are three things you can do. Number one, support the podcast by going to thebigbenshow.com/podcasts and making a donation. Number two, subscribe or share these podcasts or give me a good review on iTunes. And thirdly, get in touch. I'm always looking for more people to interview. My email is ben@thebigbenshow.com. Many thanks. Talk to you again soon.